Hello. This is the listening part of your Year 12 exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
This week, I discovered that I have co-workers who collect board games, cassette tapes, obscure musical instruments, and beer cans. And then one of my neighbors knocked on my door the other night to show me his collection of early Wonder Woman comics. Seems like once you start asking, you find out that just about everybody collects something. Gary Brockman collects buttons, old 19th century buttons.
Early 90s, I was working in publishing in New York, and long story short, I needed some buttons for a workshop we were going to do with science teachers. And did the workshop. There happened to be two people who were button collectors in that group of science teachers, and once the buttons went out on the table, the science portion of the workshop was over for them. I just sidled around to where they were owing and awing over them and asked them what was going on, and they told me they were button collectors and these were really wonderful buttons. And I asked them if they would stay around after the workshop ended and just tell me about them, and they did, and I was hooked from that point on. Button collecting has had a couple of different iterations. It was very popular during the Victorian era. As an organized hobby in the United States, it really dates back to the late 1930s. The publisher of Hobbies Magazine in Chicago was instrumental in putting together a group of people who wanted to form a national button society, which still exists and which every few years has its national convention here in Wisconsin, usually in Appleton. It caught on very quickly. World War II pretty much interrupted the development of the organization of the hobby, but once the war ended, there were chapters, state chapters, that started up all over the U.S. and local chapters, many of which are still in operation, still very active. We've just come off of a run of 8 shows in 11 weeks in 8 different states, so there are still many people who collect buttons and shows that specialize strictly in buttons and button-related materials. There's actually a taxonomy for button collectors. There's a committee and an annual meeting and a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into studying buttons and classifying them by material, by use, by pictorial subject. And every summer at the National Button Show, there are competitions in most of those classification areas. Who can put together the best tray of shell buttons using the taxonomy for shell? Who can put together the best plastic buttons? I think buttons matter in the way that any material from any culture at any point in history matters. They're windows into our past. You know, there's that really tired old saying, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And this is just one more avenue into human history, into cultural history, into technological history. You've got it all right here. You can see the development of artistic styles. You can see the development of manufacturing techniques. Everything is connected to everything else.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
This week, I discovered that I have coworkers who collect board games, cassette tapes, obscure musical instruments, and beer cans. And then one of my neighbors knocked on my door the other night to show me his collection of early Wonder Woman comics. Seems like once you start asking, you find out that just about everybody collects something. Gary Brockman collects buttons, old 19th century buttons.
Early 90s, I was working in publishing in New York, and long story short, I needed some buttons for a workshop we were going to do with science teachers. And did the workshop. There happened to be two people who were button collectors in that group of science teachers. And once the buttons went out on the table, the science portion of the workshop was over for them. I just sidled around to where they were owing and awing over them and asked them what was going on. And they told me they were button collectors and these were really wonderful buttons. And I asked them if they would stay around after the workshop ended and just tell me about them. And they did. And I was hooked from that point on. Button collecting has had a couple of different iterations. It was very popular during the Victorian era. As an organized hobby in the United States, it really dates back to the late 1930s. The publisher of Hobbies Magazine in Chicago was instrumental in putting together a group of people who wanted to form a national button society, which still exists and which every few years has its national convention here in Wisconsin, usually in Appleton. It caught on very quickly. World War II pretty much interrupted the development of the organization of the hobby, but once the war ended, there were chapters, state chapters, that started up all over the U.S. and local chapters, many of which are still in operation, still very active. We've just come off of a run of 8 shows in 11 weeks in 8 different states, so there are still many people who collect buttons and shows that specialize strictly in buttons and button-related materials. There's actually a taxonomy for button collectors. There's a committee and an annual meeting and a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into studying buttons and classifying them by material, by use, by pictorial subject. And every summer at the National Button Show, there are competitions in most of those classification areas, who can put together the best tray of shell buttons using the taxonomy for shell, who can put together the best plastic buttons. I think buttons matter in the way that any material from any culture at any point in history matters. They're windows into our past. You know, there's that really tired old saying, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And this is just one more avenue into human history, into cultural history, into technological history. You've got it all right here. You can see the development of artistic styles. You can see the development of manufacturing techniques. Everything is connected to everything else.
There is half a minute now to finish the task.
This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have a minute to read the task.
My castaway this week is the adventurer Ben Saunders. In his own words, he specialises in dragging heavy things around cold places. He's one of only three people to have skied solo to the North Pole, and he holds the record for the longest solo Arctic journey ever, entirely on foot. He says, "Nothing at home quite compares to the highs and lows I've experienced in a sledge harness, and the quest for those extremes has the potential to burn up all the money you can get your hands on and ruin every relationship you've ever had." So welcome, Ben Saunders. Introducing you today, I called you an adventurer and deliberately did not call you an explorer, because you once said, I noticed, that you know, you didn't consider yourself an explorer because explorers are people who find out where the North Pole is, and we already know where the North Pole is. Is that fair?
I've been struggling for years for a sensible sounding job title, and I haven't figured it out yet. I couldn't ever claim to exploring in the Edwardian sense of the word. I'm not naming mountain ranges or planting flags anywhere or drawing maps. So to me, the interesting thing is the sort of athletic endeavour, the fact that these journeys are still extraordinary tests of endurance, and there's still scope to try to do things that have never been done before. The first bit of each trip is very quite hard. In Antarctica, we were dragging huge amounts of weight. We were pulling 200 kilos each, 440 pounds each, and that's sort of two fat blokes in a bathtub each for 1,800 miles.
And with what you pull behind you being so important in terms of the strain of doing it each and every day in extreme cold and extreme conditions, what do you leave behind that might surprise us?
We didn't really have any special treats. We were eating 6,000 calories a day. Each day's food is vacuum-packed into a sealed bag, so there's no temptation to raid the sledge and munch a bit of extra chocolate or whatever it is.
I've had a look at a photograph of the tent that you were in. It looks like the sort of tent somebody might take to a festival. It looks... I mean, it doesn't look up to the job, to be frank. Did you fully and thoroughly prepare and understand the environment you were going into?
I've really tried to be quite professional about these trips and to focus on the training and then the equipment and the preparation. Having said that, I'm obsessed by saving weight on these trips, because the lighter the sledge is, the less you're lugging around, the higher chances of success. So the tent, everything is stripped down to the bare minimum for survival, basically.
Ben Saunders, in 2004 then, as we know, you skied to the North Pole. It was a solo trip. You were out there for 72 days. It's important, I think, just to clarify for us all, there's not somebody a mile behind you making sure that everything's fine, and there's not a chopper up above you just checking that you're progressing as you should be. You're entirely alone. Are you in these circumstances?
Very much so. Yeah, I was completely on my own for 10 weeks, 72 days.
When it comes to your music then, what sort of music suits being alone? Because you're somebody who spent a lot of time entirely alone.
Yeah, this isn't the first time I've had to choose a playlist to disappear to the middle of nowhere. So I'm normally doing things, normally walking, skiing long distances. So I've had to find music that you can listen to, you know, over and over again. Yeah, my first really big solo expedition, 2004, I found that anything vaguely melancholy had the potential to send me into these sort of emotional spirals down. Yeah, so it all had to be quite upbeat, all had to be quite motivational sort of stuff.
It's easy, isn't it, to always concentrate on the privations and the difficulties and the horrors. But actually, what are the best moments in a trip like that?
There are moments of real magic and joy. And especially when the weather is bad, you can't see much. You know, the cloud comes in and the mist, and you're travelling through what's called whiteout, and you can't really tell the difference between the sky and the snow. And there were definitely some moments of travelling through this mist on the top of the world, thinking, wow, I'm the northernmost human being on the planet right now. You know, everything is south. All the crime and corruption and wars and poverty, all that stuff is south of me. And here I am walking through a cloud on top of it all.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
My castaway this week is the adventurer Ben Saunders. In his own words, he specialises in dragging heavy things around cold places. He's one of only three people to have skied solo to the North Pole, and he holds the record for the longest solo Arctic journey ever, entirely on foot. He says, "Nothing at home quite compares to the highs and lows I've experienced in a sledge harness, and the quest for those extremes has the potential to burn up all the money you can get your hands on and ruin every relationship you've ever had." So welcome, Ben Saunders. Introducing you today, I called you an adventurer and deliberately did not call you an explorer, because you once said, I noticed, that, you know, you didn't consider yourself an explorer because explorers are people who find out where the North Pole is, and we already know where the North Pole is. Is that fair?
I've been struggling for years for a sensible sounding job title, and I haven't figured it out yet. I couldn't ever claim to exploring in the Edwardian sense of the word. I'm not naming mountain ranges or planting flags anywhere or drawing maps. So to me, the interesting thing is the sort of athletic endeavour, the fact that these journeys are still extraordinary tests of endurance, and there's still scope to try to do things that have never been done before. The first bit of each trip isn't very quite hard. In Antarctica, we were dragging huge amounts of weight. We were pulling 200 kilos each, 440 pounds each, and that's sort of two fat blokes in a bathtub each for 1,800 miles.
And with what you pull behind you being so important in terms of the strain of doing it each and every day in extreme cold and extreme conditions, what do you leave behind that might surprise us?
We didn't really have any special treats. We were eating 6,000 calories a day. Each day's food is vacuum-packed into a sealed bag, so there's no temptation to raid the sledge and munch a bit of extra chocolate or whatever it is.
I've had a look at a photograph of the tent that you were in. It looks like the sort of tent somebody might take to a festival. It looks... I mean, it doesn't look up to the job, to be frank. Did you fully and thoroughly prepare and understand the environment you were going into?
I've really tried to be quite professional about these trips and to focus on the training and then the equipment and the preparation. Having said that, I'm obsessed by saving weight on these trips, because the lighter the sledge is, the less you're lugging around, the higher chances of success. So the tent, everything is stripped down to the bare minimum for survival, basically.
Ben Saunders, in 2004 then, as we know, you skied to the North Pole. It was a solo trip. You were out there for 72 days. It's important, I think, just to clarify for us all, there's not somebody a mile behind you making sure that everything's fine, and there's not a chopper up above you just checking that you're progressing as you should be. You're entirely alone. Are you in these circumstances?
Very much so. Yeah, I was completely on my own for 10 weeks, 72 days.
When it comes to your music then, what sort of music suits being alone? Because you are somebody who spent a lot of time entirely alone.
Yeah, this isn't the first time I've had to choose a playlist to disappear to the middle of nowhere. So I'm normally doing things, normally walking, skiing long distances. So I've had to find music that you can listen to, you know, over and over again. Yeah, my first really big solo expedition, 2004, I found that anything vaguely melancholy had the potential to send me into this sort of emotional spirals down. Yeah, so it all had to be quite upbeat, all had to be quite motivational sort of stuff.
It's easy, isn't it, to always concentrate on the privations and the difficulties and the horrors. But actually, what are the best moments in a trip like that?
There are moments of real magic and joy. And especially when the weather is bad, you can't see much. You know, the cloud comes in and the mist, and you're travelling through what's called whiteout, and you can't really tell the difference between the sky and the snow. And there were definitely some moments of travelling through this mist on the top of the world, thinking, wow, I'm the northernmost human being on the planet right now. You know, everything is south. All the crime and corruption and wars and poverty, all that stuff is south of me. And here I am walking through a cloud on top of it all.
There is half a minute now to finish the task.
This is the end of task two. Go on to task three. You have a minute to read the task.
Today on The Life Scientific, we're celebrating Ada Lovelace Day, which marks the achievements of women in science and engineering. Like Ada herself, my guest today, Professor Danielle George, became passionate about machines and instrumentation at an early age. She went on to become the youngest woman to present the Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution. The theme of her lectures delivered last year was Sparks Will Fly, and Danielle is an advocate for the power of engineering to change the world. As Professor of Radio Frequency Engineering at the University of Manchester, she develops equipment that allows us to see out to the furthest reaches of the universe. Her goal, she says, is to help reverse the image crisis facing engineering in the UK. Danielle George, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in Ada Lovelace's day, nearly two centuries ago, it was unusual for a woman to be working in a field as male-dominated as engineering and computing. Many would say it's not much better now.
I think that's true, unfortunately. I think in Ada Lovelace's day, there were pioneers, and that's still true today, but there aren't many of us. But I think Ada's passion and vision for her technology have made her, and she still is, a very powerful symbol for modern women in engineering. There are really good examples of it still in modern technology. If you look at the director for engineering for Facebook, it's a woman. If you look at the vice president of engineering for Google, it's a woman. So there are great examples, but they're more like pockets rather than it be the norm.
In terms of your early influences, I hear your father was a car mechanic in Newcastle. Mm-hmm. Did this inspire an early passion with you for tinkering with machinery?
I think it probably did, but I didn't realise it at the time. So I would help my dad on a Saturday morning at his garage and things. And I just really enjoyed it. It was just sort of spending time with dad, really, rather than realising I was tinkering around with things. Actually, looking back, it has been a big influence.
Another one of your early hobbies was amateur astronomy. How did that start?
I think I went through what my parents called science phases. So I had a phase of really enjoying chemistry, and my parents bought me just a small, very cheap chemistry set, which I really enjoyed trying to blow things up and making horrible smells. And that was really interesting. But then I sort of fell out with that then and went into another phase of using a microscope. And so my parents bought me, again, just a very cheap entry-level microscope. And then I really got into the astronomy side, and my parents bought me, again, just an entry-level telescope. And that really stuck with me. I was fascinated. Even what you could see was such a small, cheap telescope. The amount of detail you could see on the moon, for example, and being able to see some of the planets, Jupiter, for example, it just really fascinated me. And that really stuck from then on. And so I realised I wanted to do something in this area when I grew up.
And did this love of science carry through your schoolwork?
It did, yeah. I was always a why child, you know, why is this, why is the sky blue, why is the grass green sort of thing. And I think that makes you a scientist. And so all of my teachers at parents' evening to my parents were saying, if she doesn't make a scientist, I'll eat my hat. But then it developed into, well, how do things work? And I think that was the sort of the engineering side of me coming out as well. So sort of the why side was a scientist and the how side was the engineer.
That's an interesting distinction. I've not heard that way of it. That's very nice.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Today on The Life Scientific, we're celebrating Ada Lovelace Day, which marks the achievements of women in science and engineering. Like Ada herself, my guest today, Professor Danielle George, became passionate about machines and instrumentation at an early age. She went on to become the youngest woman to present the Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution. The theme of her lectures delivered last year was Sparks Will Fly, and Danielle is an advocate for the power of engineering to change the world. As Professor of Radio Frequency Engineering at the University of Manchester, she develops equipment that allows us to see out to the furthest reaches of the universe. Her goal, she says, is to help reverse the image crisis facing engineering in the UK. Danielle George, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in Ada Lovelace's day, nearly two centuries ago, it was unusual for a woman to be working in a field as male-dominated as engineering and computing. Many would say it's not much better now.
I think that's true, unfortunately. I think in Ada Lovelace's day, there were pioneers, and that's still true today, but there aren't many of us. But I think Ada's passion and vision for her technology have made her, and she still is, a very powerful symbol for modern women in engineering. There are really good examples of it still in modern technology. If you look at the director for engineering for Facebook, it's a woman. If you look at the vice president of engineering for Google, it's a woman. So there are great examples, but they're more like pockets rather than it be the norm.
In terms of your early influences, I hear your father was a car mechanic in Newcastle. Did this inspire an early passion with you for tinkering with machinery?
I think it probably did, but I didn't realise it at the time. So I would help my dad on a Saturday morning at his garage and things. And I just really enjoyed it. It was just sort of spending time with dad, really, rather than realising I was tinkering around with things. Actually, looking back, it has been a big influence.
Another one of your early hobbies was amateur astronomy. How did that start?
I think I went through what my parents called science phases. So I had a phase of really enjoying chemistry, and my parents bought me just a small, very cheap chemistry set, which I really enjoyed trying to blow things up and making horrible smells. And that was really interesting. But then I sort of fell out with that then and went into another phase of using a microscope. And so my parents bought me, again, just a very cheap entry-level microscope. And then I really got into the astronomy side, and my parents bought me, again, just an entry-level telescope. And that really stuck with me. I was fascinated. Even what you could see was such a small, cheap telescope. The amount of detail you could see on the moon, for example, and being able to see some of the planets, Jupiter, for example, it just really fascinated me. And that really stuck from then on. And so I realised I wanted to do something in this area when I grew up.
And did this love of science carry through your schoolwork?
It did, yeah. I was always a why child, you know, why is this, why is the sky blue, why is the grass green sort of thing. And I think that makes you a scientist. And so all of my teachers at parents' evening to my parents were saying, if she doesn't make a scientist, I'll eat my hat. But then it developed into, well, how do things work? And I think that was the sort of the engineering side of me coming out as well. So sort of the why side was a scientist and the how side was the engineer.
An interesting distinction. I've not heard that way about. That's very nice.
There is half a minute now to finish the task.
This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.